Welcome to episode 192 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live August 23rd, 2020. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss a recent topic or news and how it relates to you. In this episode, Ben and Scott get back on track and start off the show talking about the new Microsoft Flight Simulator, as well as the latest DARPA AI project. And from there, we dive into Microsoft 365 and Azure news, talking about the Microsoft Cloud Shell, about Internet Explorer 11, Microsoft Forms Pro, Microsoft Ignite, and other news and announcements related to Microsoft 365 and Azure. It's episode 192. A month from now, we're going to be recording 200, Scott. What are we going to do for... I feel like we should do something for 200. We didn't do anything for 100. We are very poor at celebrating our accomplishments.
Well, what could we do? Continue to stay inside some more? You got that going for us.
Sure. I mean, 2 months, what? 2 months, it's the end of some month in the year 2020.
Yeah, it is. It'll be down to like...
End of what? August, September, October? It'll be like Halloween, right? Ish?
Yeah.
Not quite.
Yeah, so it'll only be, you know, 105, and it'll be nice and humid outside.
Yeah. Maybe we can dress up since we did start doing video, Scott. Last week's episode, I actually published. We're recording our video. I went in and mocked it up a little bit, but we actually published video of us on YouTube. So if you want the whole unedited video version of the podcast, you can go find it on YouTube now. And we'll see. Hopefully I can keep doing it. I need to fix my camera though. I have a stand-up desk that wiggles, as you can probably see in my video.
Yeah. Well, next we'll have to add not only a non-wiggly camera, but like a Discord chat or something like that.
Oh, man. This is going to get to be a lot of work.
I know.
So do you want my random news for the day? I have two random news articles for you. Which one do you want? One or two? This one's more interesting.
Flight Simulator came out. Have you played it yet?
No, but it has a 212-story building in a city.
It's in Melbourne, Australia. Yes. Do you know how they got that 212-story obelisk inside the middle of the city?
You found one of my random links, and I have not read it all yet, other than somebody had a typo somewhere, and they scraped the data from there, and that's how it got there. But I have not... Yeah. Had a chance to read all the details.
So mapping is an interesting thing. You know, there's a lot of companies out there that potentially provide map data. There's certainly some that build their own. You think maybe about like Google or Apple driving cars around for their street views and things like that. But they're also collecting telemetry on road data. You've got navigation applications like coming from the TomToms of the world. Maybe you've got Waze. So there's kind of commercial open source things out there. And one of the things that Microsoft bases its data, map data off of for not only Flight Simulator, but things like potentially Bing is OpenStreetMap. And in OpenStreetMap, there's an entry for a building in Melbourne, Australia, which is two stories tall, but was inadvertently entered through a typo to be 212 stories. And when you are leveraging OpenStreetMap and kind of taking it as a source of truth, you would just say, hey, here's a thing that we need to render on our map in real time. So combine it with satellite imagery data and kind of do the 3D overlay on it.
And there you have a 212-story building.
Yep.
Have you played it yet? It looks like... I haven't seen how big it is. It said it comes on 10 DVDs, and I watched some YouTube videos of people getting like their Microsoft unboxing kits of it with all the accessories. I won't lie, I was kind of jealous. All these people getting like top-of-the-line yokes and sticks and throttle controls along with the game from Microsoft.
I don't have any of that stuff. And embarrassingly, I can't start the download this month because I live under the Comcast regime. And if I do, I will go over my data cap because it is a massive, massive download. So it's on the order of 130 to 150 gigs just to kind of like run through the pre-install for it.
Got it. Which sounds about right if it's 10 DVDs worth of data.
Yeah. So if you are a Game Pass subscriber, like a Microsoft Game Pass Ultimate subscriber. There's a version in the Windows Store that you can get through Game Pass for quote-unquote free because it is part of your existing subscription.
I wonder if I can play it in a VM.
You really cannot.
Yeah, that was kind of my guess.
Yeah. That was going to be my first thing, was like loaded up inside Parallels, but I actually went and stole one of my kids' laptops because it's got a newer Radeon chip in it.
That's funny.
Yeah. Maybe I'll come over to your place and like just hang on the Wi-Fi and download it or something.
Perfect. Well, because I have two internet connections now. So I have 2 1-terabyte limits. I have a terabyte limit from AT&T and a terabyte limit from Xfinity. So we'll just pick the one that I'm the lowest on. You can download it on that one.
That's the way to do it. Yeah. So Flight Simulator, that'll be the thing to do.
All right. So my next one is along the same lines. Did you follow any of the DARPA stuff the last few days?
I have not followed DARPA stuff the last few days.
Okay. So DARPA had the Alpha Dogfight Trials. And what this was, I should send you a link to this, is AI competition with AI dogfight. I think that, there it goes, with AI dogfighting. So essentially a simulated dogfight between F-16. So there were 8 teams. They've whittled it down over the course of, apparently this whole thing has been going on for a while, but they whittled it down over the course of the last year or so, and then had the finals of it over the last 3 days, where these 8 teams were all having simulated dogfights, all using AI, teaching their models as they were running through these simulations. And then they capped it all off with the winner of the competition flying against one of the top F-16 pilots. And it was an AI versus human dogfight in a simulated environment. I watched some of it off and on, and it was fascinating to watch the AI battles, but then watching AI versus humans. And all I can say, Scott, is the human race is in trouble. We're going to get exterminated by the machines.
Skynet is real.
Skynet is real. It wasn't even close. Like, it was absolute domination by the AI flying the F-16 versus the human. I'm not a pilot, nor have I ever been in the military, but just watching it from my perspective, a lot of it seemed to be the fact that using the AI, once the planes got close to having them in the cone of a legitimate gunshot, the AI was able to precisely aim a lot better than the human was. Kind of like, you know, when you go play video games and if you put like any of the first person shooters on the expert level and those bots always seem to be able to precisely aim, it kind of felt like that in these dogfights. That aiming ability was just a lot more steady and a lot more precise than somebody's hands.
You know, I think that was always one of the things, right? Computers don't have any, you know, they don't have any shake. They don't have any muscle memory to overcome or, you know, getting nervous in those situations. You also have to contend with, if an AI is driving the process, like say it was even a real plane that was being driven by AI, there's nothing to contend with in the way of natural physical force. So you don't have to worry about overcoming G-forces in a bank or anything like that. And as a human, right, as a bag of like meaty flesh, you are at a tactical disadvantage.
Yeah. So it was interesting. They streamed a bunch of it on YouTube. So I think that all the YouTube videos are still out there. So we can link to this article, or you can go search for the Alpha Dogfight Trials and watch some of the videos. There's definitely a lot of it you can skip through because there was a lot of talking that, I mean, the fun part was the AI battles.
That's the best kind of YouTube, all the stuff that you can skip through. Maybe you just go find the Alpha Dogfight on TikTok and then doom scroll your way through it.
Yes, TikTok is banned in the US, Scott. No TikTok, bad TikTok.
Not yet.
We're going to make the internet great again.
It still has days left. Days, I say.
Okay, and that's all the political stuff we're getting into on this podcast.
Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at intelligink.com/podcast. That's intelligink.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business.
Here's a terrible segue. Doomsday Internet Explorer is going to meet its doom in 2021 when it comes to the Microsoft 365 apps. So I think this was, they announced it the 17th. They announced it 4 days ago. So earlier this week, August 17, Microsoft announced you have 1 year of support for Internet Explorer 11 and Microsoft Edge Legacy to work or to be supported. I guess it doesn't mean it's not going to work, but to be supported in Internet Explorer 11. So come August 17, 2021, the only supported browsers for Microsoft 365 are going to be the new Edge, and then I'm going to assume Chrome, Safari, Firefox are all going to stay supported as well. But maybe, finally, people are starting to kick IE11 to the curb.
One can only hope. You know, it was a weird road to get to Credge, and I think some people are still put off by the way the upgrades occurred. You know, if you're still on like a, say like a Windows 10 device that hasn't been upgraded to Credge yet, you know, you got to go through that whole full screen upgrade experience, and it feels very much like it's being just shoved into your face and pushed down your throat, whether you like the taste of it or not. But it's a good thing. It gets everything to you a better place. You get off kind of Internet Explorer, the older Internet Explorer and the Trident engine, you get away from Edge HTML, and everything comes over to just a better, more compatible world when you consider web app compatibility in the broader spectrum.
Yes. And it will help people like Gary.
Yep.
Because Gary commented on this and said, will Edge natively support SharePoint view and File Explorer with the whole ActiveX thing? Gary, you should not be using that anyways, so it doesn't matter.
Yes.
Sorry, Gary. I don't know if you listen, but if you do, I apologize, but stop using it.
For organizations that are in that boat, say you have on-premises applications that you feel can't be upgraded, or there's some major blocker there for you, there is fast track assistance. So if you are on an eligible Windows 10 or Microsoft 365 subscription, you can actually have, and you have more than 150 seats, I believe is the threshold to get in there, you can have fast track come in, and they will provide things like remote deployment guidance and compatibility assistance. So they can help you do things like inventory the list of sites that might require this thing called Internet Explorer mode, and then help provide that operational guidance for you to do things like enable that. So they can do a lot of things that kind of on-site support is out of scope for them. They're not going to do project management for you, but they can come in and integrate with your team and your kind of operational team, right, on your premises, and help you figure some of that stuff out.
Yeah, there's definitely, like, they understand that people are going to have some struggles with this, and they are, I feel like, at least from this and some of the programs they're offering, they're trying to help people out and help them smooth out this transition as best that they're able.
Yeah, so you've got things like Fast Track out there,
and that's like that whole App Assure, which I think is what you were talking about, where they'll go in and kind of help you do that app analysis. And
there's kind of two things there. So there's Fast Track and the Fast Track program. And then there's also App Assure, which is off the cuff. I think that's more targeted to this recognition that there are legacy applications out there that just need to go away. They need to be transformed and they need to be updated. And App Assure potentially steps in a little bit more heavy-handed and can help with that transformation. So like, this thing is mission critical and it needs to be rewritten, but we don't know how to rewrite it. You know, what's the type of guidance that you potentially need as a customer to make that happen so that legacy Internet Explorer can finally be put to bed and can just live out its life watching soap operas and, you know, eating Cheetos, whatever it is.
Yep. Oh, I did scroll down. The Microsoft 365 Edge product team also replied to Gary and said, stop using it. They were much more diplomatic than that.
I'm sure. Politically correct is the
thing. Yes.
There's all sorts of things going on there. Another legacy thing that is getting cleaned up is code signing requirements for Windows updates. In the past, you might have things that were, say, signed with a SHA-1 or SHA-2 algorithm. Now everything's coming over to SHA-2. So this does have some impacts, particularly for those customers who run legacy operating systems. So in context, we'll define legacy as Windows 7, Server 2008 R2, and also Windows Server 2008 as well. And for those too, they're going to be subject to these SHA-2 code signing requirements, because every update that comes from Windows Update is going to be signed this way as of, well, last month, July 2019. And it's not just Windows updates, like things on the Download Center got updated as well. So there's all sorts of like downstream impacts here to things to think about, particularly if you have legacy clients that sit out there.
Got it. You realize that was not last month. That was last year.
Ah, whatever.
It's 2020. It's been a long 2020.
It has.
They're like officially discontinued as of this month.
Yeah. Maybe that's it. I'm getting all confused.
Yeah, it's fine.
But there was a bunch of stuff in the Download Center that like just straight up deprecated out. And
it just killed it off.
It isn't there anymore.
Yes. No, it was more that you said last month and then you said July 2019. And I was like, wait a minute, has 2020 really been that long or that messed up?
It has.
It really has. But yeah, if you do go look at the timeline, like August 2020 was when those SHA-1 service-based endpoints are officially discontinued. So this has been a process and it has reached the end of the road. You know what else has reached the end of the road? We're full of deprecation announcements today. Forms Pro in name has reached the end of the road. Microsoft Forms Pro is now Microsoft Dynamics 365 Customer Voice. Apparently Forms is still Forms. Apparently now we have Microsoft Forms and we have Microsoft Dynamics 365 Customer Voice, otherwise known as MD365CV. In my own head. Doesn't make any sense. Apparently, so I've been reading a few other articles. I don't know if I sent this one to you or not. There was a message in the Message Center about this back in July, according to, so Daniel Glenn and Daryl Webster were talking about this. And they said back in July, there was a Message Center update about this. It's bizarre. One, because it doesn't look like it actually writes any of that data back to CDS, which is kind of what I thought the whole purpose of a feedback tool for Dynamics 365 would be, is let people take surveys, let people answer questions, do all of this, and let's write it back to Dynamics 365.
You mean like integrate into the ecosystem that it's a part of by name?
Yeah, that type of thing. It doesn't look like it does that. And I don't... This is another one of those I frankly just don't understand. If I go into my environment, it still all says Forms Pro too. Like I can go into my forms.microsoft.com and it says Forms Pro and it lets me pick my Power Platform environment that I'm working in and I have the extra features, but I don't see anything in my tenant about Dynamics 365 Customer Voice product. There's very little backstory, I guess, to why this is happening and what the purpose of it is, to the point that it was even just announced in a Twitter post. Like there's not even an official Microsoft blog post for this.
Just the landing page.
Right. The landing page says the name's been changed. There was the message in the Message Center, and then there was a Twitter post on August 17, which apparently, according to the Message Center, was like a month after it actually changed its name. But when you first sent this to me, I actually asked, I was like, is there two Microsoft Forms Pro products, and that's why they're renaming this? It made that little sense to me. But no, this is the Microsoft Forms, the Pro SKU of the standard Microsoft Form service that we're used to. I don't know.
You don't know, huh?
I don't know.
Outlook add-ins are a great way to improve productivity and save time in the workplace, and Sperry Software has all the add-ins you'll ever need. The Save as PDF add-in is a bestseller and is great for project backups, legal discovery, and more. This add-in saves the email and attachments as PDF files. It's easy to download, easy to install, and Sperry Software's unparalleled customer service is always ready to help. Download a free trial at sperrysoftware.com, SperrySoftware.com, and see for yourself how great Save as PDF is. Listeners can get 20% off their order today by entering the code CLOUDIT. That's CLOUDIT, CLOUDIT, all one word at checkout. Sperry Software, work in email, not on email. So that's all my deprecation news. I have some new announcements too. Do you want me to keep going or do you have one you want to talk about now?
Well, I mean, there's always new things out there. Did you see that the Cloud Shell was open sourced?
I saw the article and I have not had any chance to read about it other than I saw the Cloud Shell was open sourced.
Yeah, so we've talked about Cloud Shell in the past and it's that little, the shell in the cloud that pops up inside the Azure portal.
Yep.
When you go ahead and click the little terminal icon, it's available inside of mobile tools like the Azure mobile app on iOS and Google. So having access to a PowerShell or pure Bash shell on the go kind of thing. So Microsoft has done a couple different things there. They open sourced Cloud Shell. And specifically, when I say open sourced, they currently have pushed that image out or that project out onto GitHub as part of the official kind of Azure organization. And there's a couple nice things about that. So you might not want to build Cloud Shell for yourself because you just kind of rely on it in the portal and that's enough for you and that's okay. But I think the more kind of interesting thing there is the ability to crawl through that source code and be able to understand all the tools that Microsoft deploys as part of Cloud Shell. Like what goes into that build pipeline and what does that look like? Because Cloud Shell is more than just Bash or PowerShell. It includes things like JQ, Terraform's in there, Ansible's in there. There's things like SQL command. Obviously, there's the Azure CLI. There's the Azure PowerShell commandlets. So there's lots and lots of stuff in there. And you might want to understand not only what goes in, because it's surprisingly not documented in totality on docs.microsoft.com, but what versions of things go in and potentially have insights into when newer versions of those things are going to come, right? Do you deploy maybe like a .NET Core console application that you have your operators download through Cloud Shell so they can do kind of machinations against other Azure resources? Then you're drawing dependencies on things like, hey, what's the version of .NET Core that's installed in Cloud Shell? So that can be helpful to understand and, you know, just generally manage that life cycle along the way. Now, they open source Cloud Shell. They also announced some new previews for Cloud Shell kind of right alongside that, which potentially got lost in the noise. And one of the perhaps more interesting ones there that I saw is you can also now deploy Cloud Shell directly into an Azure virtual network. So this means that you can not only still deploy Cloud Shell, but you can have it connect directly to resources in your connected virtual network. So those might be virtual machines. Maybe you've got like a file share that you want to connect to. Say you're managing a private Kubernetes cluster. Well, now Cloud Shell can get in there and do all those things for you, which potentially cuts down on you having to do things like leave a jump box or a bastion host up all the time. You get better resource management because you're deploying on demand. You can still do things like mount your custom drives. It's kind of just more goodness for that ecosystem and makes it a little easier to latch onto.
Interesting. I'm assuming that if you can deploy it that way, you can also not only deploy it directly into that environment, but then segment it out off from other environments, which would give you the ability to allow users to go use Cloud Shell against certain resources, but not necessarily even
have to worry about like RBAC controls are securing the other resources because Cloud Shell is truly isolated to just a single network or a single environment.
You still worry about those things, right? Like RBAC and ABAC and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so still worry about them. But there's an extra layer of security. That's probably a better way to phrase that.
I look at it as not potentially an extra layer of security from like an exfiltration perspective. Like you are like, okay, they're deployed in Cloud Shell and can they get out to the other things? It's like they're deployed in Cloud Shell and what can they get into while they're here? And it's going to be those private resources, right? There's been this steady march to enable more private connectivity to Azure resources over things like private endpoints and private link. So how do I interact with these PaaS services and with these IaaS things in a 100% privatized manner? And now you're starting to get more of those capabilities. So for Cloud Shell, this becomes interesting because Cloud Shell is rendered through a web browser. So you still need a service Yep. that you can connect to go ahead and render that Cloud Shell session, right? You need to bring that back to me as a client. So the way that manifests itself is you're not just going to deploy Cloud Shell and a virtual network. You're going to draw some other dependencies here. And one of the big ones is going to be a dependency on Azure Relay. So Azure Relays, or you might have heard me talk about like hybrid service bus relays in the past. Azure Relay is a service. You have two disparate endpoints that are not able to directly reach each other. So like in this case, Cloud Shell is sitting in your virtual network and now it's isolated and your client over here. So the relay can act as that go-between and help all that happen over a secure tunnel.
Got it. Yep. Interesting. That's
cool as well, because you go like, well, hold on. We put Cloud Shell into a virtual network, and now you're telling me I'm going to open up a relay, and it's going to be on the public network, public internet. It doesn't have to be. Relays can be configured to do things like make them only accessible from a specific network or from a specific network segment. So you can almost think of like Cloud Shell JIT to get it going, which is really cool.
Got it. Because if you can isolate all that, you can do site-to-site VPN and keep it all local and not have any public-facing access to it.
Correct.
Nice. I have another update. This one, I remember this being announced when it got... So when I saw this blog article, I remember this being announced, I think, at Ignite last year. So almost a year ago. And do you remember when they talked about automatically adjusting people's gaze in video calls? Because even if you are watching this video on YouTube, like I tend to look down here because your video is over here instead of at my camera up here. Microsoft was going to roll out the ability to actually fix your eyes so it looks like you're actually looking at the camera, even though you're not looking at the camera. That is now available. So it's powered by artificial intelligence and the onboard neural network accelerator. Eye contact helps to adjust your gaze on video calls and recordings so you can appear to be looking directly at the camera. Well, all of this is powered by AI. It is only available if you're using the Surface Pro X.
Which, I mean, that's everybody, right? That's
yeah, no? I mean, no. I think when I first saw this, I had the anticipation that because it was all AI-based and kind of automatically doing that, they were going to roll it out as like a Teams feature, leveraging services in the cloud so it could kind of pick up your eyes on the camera and then adjust them in real time on Teams video or something. Apparently, no. There are still specific hardware requirements around those, and that is the Surface Pro X.
All in due time.
Yes. I don't know. Oh, last year, Microsoft, with custom Microsoft Silicon, there's something in the Microsoft Silicon. We believe a various number of these AI experiences will be infused across other Surface products. I don't know. Apparently there's some very specific hardware requirement with this eye adjustment that is in only the Surface Pro X. And maybe as they update all the other Surface devices over a period of time, they'll start adding another hardware or whatever is needed to do that eye adjustment. But it doesn't give me a lot of hope that this will come anytime soon to like my team's video calls.
Well, not your Teams calls. Maybe it'll be in your Zoom calls when Zoom does it first.
Maybe. I don't think we're supposed to say that. Oh, well, we said it. Yeah, we'll have to see. But that was interesting more not from the perspective that it finally came out, but from the requirements on it, because that was not what I expected. And then one other thing, we don't need to spend a lot of time on this. If you are looking to get involved at Ignite, they have made all the announcements, virtual 48 hours, a lot like they did Build. But if you are a community individual member and want to try to get involved, they have these table topics at Microsoft Ignite. And there's a open call for moderators for these table topics, where it's essentially just moderating a small group discussion. So I think it kind of sounds like a lot like the sessions we did last year, Scott, where it's more of roundtable discussion. And this will just be roundtable video discussion. And they did say that from a community member perspective, everything I have seen so far is this is the only way community members are going to get to be involved in Ignite, because naturally doing it virtually, they had to scale back, I think, on number of sessions, presenters. I mean, you can't do an event the same way, and you can't get as many people involved just due to the pure logistics of trying to organize that many virtual presenters. So go take a look at that. If you want to get involved, fill out the form in Microsoft Forms. I could have tied that in. I had so many segues into that one. You could tie that. Go fill out the Microsoft form to see if you can get a table topic at Microsoft Ignite.
Yeah. Go fill out the form for the forum for the thing.
Yeah.
One more new thing. And we were...
All right.
I was ranting about this recently. Did you see that potentially there is a change coming to Teams for a new conversation button?
No.
So that your replies sit in your replies, and then underneath that, rather than just having another text box that you start typing into that looks like the reply box, you would have a button. Imagine this, a button, like a real button that just says new conversation on it.
So you have to... So would the text box then be for replies? And if you wanted to start a new thread, you'd have to actually... It would take extra effort to start a new conversation. It'd be nice and easy to reply.
That is what it looks like. So Louise Fries, one of the MVPs who does those awesome sketch notes, she posted a little animation of potentially what that button looks like and how it acts. So potentially coming to a tenant near you. But I haven't seen it announced anyplace else. So
I haven't either. But that's interesting. That would be a very welcome addition.
Right.
Although, to be fair, I don't have a lot of Teams conversations because I don't like to converse with myself and my own tenant.
Ah, well.
It's more when I'm guests and other tenants that I have conversations.
I have a lot of conversations in Teams. And it is.
I can imagine you do. Because you're probably not even allowed to use email. You probably only are allowed to use
something,
Teams.
Something dog food.
Yeah.
That's a funny thing.
What, the email versus Teams chats?
Yeah. And there's certain, I think, like, dogmatic principles around that, potentially within even Microsoft. One of the things my team does is we monitor a distribution list, right? People can ask questions and they can kind of come to the program managers of the wider product group and they can say, hey, I'm running into a problem with X, Y, or Z. Can you help me out?
Okay.
The way that mailing list was spun up was through a team, through an Office 365 group that was then Teams enabled. So it is a team that has an email address associated with it.
Got it.
Now there's two things out there, right? There's a distribution list and there's the underlying team that sits behind it. So you would think that over time, the DL would kind of die out, hopefully, and you could have more of those organic conversations in Teams. Uh-huh. But what happens is the Teams channels that are associated with that group, they're largely ignored. And conversations, like somebody will ask a question in there and it'll sit for, you know, weeks sometimes until somebody comes in and says, hey, you know, nobody responds to the things in here. Send an email to the group. It's like, yeah, okay. Well, maybe there's ways for us to do better there.
So that's what I do. My emoji, my face palm emoji. There's my own emoji since we're doing video. Yeah. I don't think we'll ever get away from email. It's going to take, I don't know. I have nothing. But I agree. I don't think chat conversations are the email killer by any stretch of the imagination. My two cents. But with that, we should probably wrap it up for the day because I have a meeting. Oh, I have a little time yet.
Yeah. We gotta go refill the coffee.
Yes. In my Microsoft coffee cup, compliments of Ignite that we won't be attending this year. We're going to have to figure out how to do the whole podcast thing with Ignite this year.
Yep. Yep. We'll get there.
Yeah. We'll figure it out because that's like a month away now.
Yes. September 22nd through the 24th.
Yes. Go work hard.
All right.
Reply to those emails.
Thanks, Ben.
All right. We'll talk to you later, Scott.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.